This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
Hello, we're here in the Black Holes in a Balloon Universe conference in Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. And we're here with Philippe Podzielowski. He gave a talk yesterday, a really interesting talk about ultraluminous X-ray sources. So could you explain us a little bit about these sources?
Yes, I mean, these ultraluminous X-ray sources are very bright X-ray sources, and they're much brighter than the normal X-ray sources we know in our galaxy. I mean, in our galaxy, we have about 100 X-ray sources, and they're all so-called X-ray binaries. And these are systems where you have a star transferring mass to a compact object. A compact object is usually a black hole or neutron star, and that releases a lot of gravitational energy, and that is seen in X-rays. But there's a certain maximum luminosity one observes, which is called the Eddington limit, because when sources reach that luminosity, then the radiation pressure stops any accretion. And so we don't expect sources to be more luminous than the Eddington limit. But these ultra-luminous X-ray sources are much more luminous than what you would get if you had, let's say, a 10 solar mass black hole, as is typically in our galaxy. And that makes these systems very unusual. And one of the ideas is that perhaps these are not systems like in our galaxies containing a 10 solar mass black hole, but a much more massive black hole, a so-called intermediate mass black hole. It might have a mass of 100 or perhaps even 100,000 times the mass of the Sun.
So if they're intermediate mass, obviously we've got kind of what we would regard as maybe small black holes and then the very massive ones. Why are these intermediate mass black holes particularly interesting?
Well, one of the big questions is how do you actually form these very supermassive black holes? Like in our galaxy, at the center of our galaxy, we have a black hole that's 4 million times the mass of the Sun. But how did it actually get there? And this is one of the big unknowns and was at the center of many of the talks at this meeting, in fact. And one idea, of course, is that you start with smaller black holes and they then somehow merge, building up intermediate mass black holes and ultimately these very massive black holes at the centers of galaxies.
So do you find these ultra-luminous X-ray sources? Do you find them everywhere in all the galaxies, or where do you find them?
Well, they are not actually very common. In a typical galaxy like ours, you might expect perhaps one or two, not more than that. But they're very common in galaxies that form a lot of young stars. There are, for example, the Antennae galaxies, where you have two galaxies colliding, and that produces a lot of star formation. And you see many of these ultraluminous X-ray sources associated with these bursts of star formation.
So you don't see them in elliptical galaxies?
You don't see the bright ones in elliptical galaxies at all, yes. But the very fact that you see them associated with massive stars suggests that they might not be intermediate mass black holes, but just more extreme versions of the normal stellar mass black holes which we see in our galaxy. And this is what I talked about yesterday.
So how do you try to calculate the mass of the black hole, or what makes us think that, in fact, all the X-ray emission is the result of a black hole?
Now, in our own galaxy, these are X-ray binaries, and you can measure the radial velocity curve, the Doppler shift produced by the companion star, and there you can measure the mass dynamically. And so we know that there are black holes of around 10 solar masses in our galaxy. Now, in these, you can't, and so the argument is more indirect. It's just based on the fact that they are more luminous than you think would be possible if the Eddington limit was obeyed.
How do they get around the Eddington limit? I mean, it's this sort of idea that all the radiation that's coming out, all the energy, would actually push away any further matter. So how can it sort of get past that barrier?
Now, the basic assumption in that limit is that the accretion onto the black hole is spherically symmetric, so that the radiation exactly opposes the gravitational attraction. But in these X-ray binaries, that's not the case, because usually you accrete through a disk. And that already allows to violate the Eddington limit, because you can accrete in one direction and radiate in another direction. But that doesn't help you a lot. It helps you a little bit. But there are other ideas of how you can do this, and one is called a photon bubble. And the idea is that if you have magnetic fields, then you can squeeze the radiation out of the matter and form bubbles of photons that then can escape easily. So that requires magnetic fields, and it's not clear whether this mechanism works. But it's certainly a way of how you could, in principle, violate the Eddington limit, perhaps by a factor of 10 or so. Probably not a factor of 100.
So you couldn't still form really supermassive black holes with this concept?
Well, not from these systems, no. And indeed, what we showed is that these systems are consistent with the normal stellar mass black holes. And we showed this by doing binary calculations, where we calculate how much mass is transferred from a massive star to the black hole. And the mass transfer rates are very high. They're high enough to power the observed luminosities and for a long time, provided you can meet the Eddington limit. Right? So there's no real problem from a stellar evolution point of view explaining all these ultra-luminous systems in star-forming galaxies.
And do you also observe them, because, I mean, they really ultra-luminous in X-rays, do they also have another counterpart like optical or radio or gamma ray burst or something?
Well, that's a good point. Most of them don't. However, if they are binary systems, then they should have a massive companion star and you should be able to detect them. And there are now about 10 systems where an optical counterpart has been detected. And in all cases, the counterpart is consistent with a massive star. But now that you have a counterpart, you might in principle even be able to measure the Doppler velocities, and that would be a way to weigh the black hole again. But that has not been possible so far. But it's probably something that will happen in the next few years.
Do you need like interferometry or?
No, just normal spectroscopic observations are fine. The problem is that these are very massy systems. There's a lot of material around, and you don't quite know where the lines you observe actually come from. And that makes it hard. But technologically, it's not difficult.
So if you do have a star in a system with a black hole, let's say 100 solar masses, obviously the black hole may be quite a bit more massive than the star. So where has it acquired its mass from, do we know?
Well, that's a very good question. It's not clear how you form these intermediate mass black holes, actually. One idea is that if you're in a young cluster, and massive stars are usually born in a cluster environment, you might get runaway collisions where young massive stars merge, and that leads to runaway, and you might produce a supermassive star, which could then produce a fairly massive black hole. However, recent calculations suggest that you may be able to get a star that's perhaps 200 or 300 times the mass of the Sun, but not much more than that. But 100 would certainly be possible. And then you, of course, you still need to capture a companion star to make it into a binary system.
Yes. And then when we have a black hole like the very supermassive one at the heart of our galaxy, do we think that maybe these intermediate black holes are going to end up as part of that? Would they go to the center of the galaxy, or will they just continue orbiting around and remain isolated from it?
I mean, most of the systems which we are talking about are very far from the galactic, from the center of the galaxy, and they will stay there. But when you have collisions, for example, between galaxies, and if each of these galaxies has a black hole in the center, then the black holes may also merge. And this is one of the ways of how you may be able to build up supermassive black holes. But they're not related to most of the systems which we have been talking about. But they should also exist.
Do you also get ultra-luminous X-rays from the center of a galaxy or no?
In most so-called active galactic nuclei, the accretion rates are believed to be significantly below the Eddington limit. But there may be some systems where the luminosity exceeds the Eddington limit, but the problem is in most systems one doesn't actually know the mass. So there may well be analogs, but they would be much more luminous in the centers of galaxies.
I think there's emission from the black hole at the center of our galaxy, but it's not particularly significant.
Yes, it's extremely low. So it's extremely inactive.
Okay. Which is good news, I suppose, for us, really.
Well, it doesn't matter that much. It's far away.
It's not so. I sometimes imagine if we were in an active galaxy that we would be getting blasted by a dangerous quantity of X-rays.
Well, I think that would only be true if we were actually in the direction of the jet from the active galactic nucleus. But otherwise, I think it's not so dangerous. I think gamma ray bursts are more dangerous.
So there's a lot of black holes around, but not particularly risky for us.
Yes, I mean, there may be lots and lots of intermediate mass black holes, and we just don't know about them. They may have formed in early stage, perhaps even shortly after the Big Bang. But we wouldn't see them, and if they don't have a companion star or don't accrete gas from some environment, you wouldn't see them.
By the talks that we had yesterday as well, does this intermediate black hole, will they evaporate as well, or do you don't expect that?
No, they are far too massive. I mean, you need really tiny black holes, like the mass of the moon or so.
Yeah.
Those would be able to evaporate in the lifetime of the universe, but these will live forever.
Okay. Okay, well, thank you very much for the interview.
You're welcome.